Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Thursday. Jimmy Akins here. 2 hours of open forum. 888-318-7884, the number. Open forum for any question you've got. You don't have to be Catholic. It means open to everyone. And pretty much any question is okey-doke. You can ask questions particularly about the Catholic faith, about the Bible or the Pope or the saints or the sacraments or something like that. You can ask questions of a more generally religious or philosophical nature. And Jimmy just is interested in everything. Jimmy has a podcast called Jimmy Akins' Mysterious World, where if you've heard of it, he's probably covered it over there. So call with any question. 888-318-7884. Jimmy is a senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, which has got to be now one of the best-selling books of this apostolate's history, I would imagine. I mean, I don't have anything to back that up except hard, cold numbers, but I think it definitely is. Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Hey, how you doing, Cy?
Very well, thank you. I think I'm right in saying that. This is an apostolate.
It's certainly one of our best selling books in recent history. I'd have to check the records to see if it's all time, but it is proved to be very popular.
We had a young man who came by here for a visit today, who works with Focus, and he said to me, "How long have you been here at Catholic Answers?" And I did the in my head, it's exactly three and a half years today. So, yeah, it's my three and a half anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
For me, it is 27 years and 17 days.
Wow. That's almost exactly the same between the two of us. Wow. 27.
Yeah. Within an order, a couple of orders of magnitude.
Right. Right. Well, congratulations on your 27-year, 17-day anniversary, Jimmy.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask you in a little while. I'm going to make people wait. I'll ask you in a little while about what's on Jimmy Akins' Mysterious World this week. But there are, in the meantime, people or a person on every single one of our lines. So shall we just jump right into it?
Yeah.
All right, let's start with Anonymous watching on YouTube. Anonymous, you know who you are, right? Are you there with us?
Hi.
Hi, Anonymous. Got a question for Jimmy Akin?
Yes. Strange hypothetical question, though, but it has to do with what I was asking. What if there was, you know, with the notion of human progress in the near future, let's say there was a perfect secular liberal utopian society that was finally established where pain and suffering and death were just completely eliminated? And it was, you know, totally irrational to believe in God from that point on, since everything was pretty much, you know, perfect, or there was no problems anymore. How would a Christian or a religious person survive in that environment?
Well, if it was a utopia where there was no pain or suffering, it would be pretty cool. You know, pain and suffering are no fun, at least in my experience. So that aspect of it would be actually quite fine. In terms of how would it square with the Christian faith? Well, the Christian faith acknowledges that there are different phases in the history of the world, and some phases are beset by more problems than others. And if we were living in a utopia type situation, then, you know, it would just be one of the better periods in world history. If I was living in such an era, I would say, well, it's great to be living in this time right now, but it's not going to last, because the faith reveals that before the end of the world, and there will be an end to history, before that happens, there will be an unleashing of the forces of evil. So even if it gets really good for a while, it's going to get bad again before the end. And so that's how I look at it.
Are you stunned, Anonymous? What do you think?
Well, yeah, that's very interesting. So it means it's sort of like the world's not going to always be perfect. You know, there will be bad things that could come about eventually, especially prior to the end of time. There will be some degree of suffering, I take it.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that before we get to that point, things can't get really good. Now, you know, in the 19th century, there was what's sometimes called the myth of progress, and myth in the sense of it being a powerfully motivating belief that people had that there was progress and everything was getting better. And in a lot of ways, that was true. But then came World War One, and then came World War Two, and then came the threat of atomic war, and then came 9/11. And so the myth of progress is also myth in another sense, that it's we're not, at least our recent experience hasn't been an unrelenting, you know, drive towards better and better situations. There are ups and downs. In the future, we could have some big ups, but before the end, there will be a down.
Anonymous, thank you. Appreciate you getting us started on Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Up next is Giovanni in Rhode Island, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Giovanni, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello, fellas. I have a question about the veneration of the saints. I don't have any problem with the statues. I think Exodus showed like two examples of like, yeah, it's okay to have statues and whatnot. But the veneration thing is often something that eludes me.
Okay, well, veneration is just a form of showing respect. And God doesn't have a problem with showing respect to people in conjunction with the amount of respect that is their due. You know, in fact, we have exhortations in the New Testament to show people their proper respect. We owe one kind of respect to our parents. We owe another kind of respect to our kinsmen. We owe another kind of respect to our leaders in the church. We owe another kind of respect to our leaders in society. And we owe another kind of respect to God's friends, to the people who have followed him faithfully and who are with him in heaven. And how that respect gets expressed varies according to culture, but fundamentally veneration is a form of respect, and you want to give people their props.
Can I ask a follow-up, though?
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Go ahead.
I think it's the reason I have such a hard time accepting this or trying to understand it is because I come from an anti-Catholic house, right? They believe that the Catholics need to worship idols. I'm like, no, I don't think so. But like, whenever they mention they pray to the saints and they do all this extra stuff, I'm like, it's kind of hard for me to accept the Catholic worldview. If you could show me historical evidence of it or biblical, that'd be cool. Perhaps that set my mind at ease.
Evidence of what specifically?
Like to show venerations to the saint. To the saints or Mary, right?
Okay.
That's what I'm looking for.
Okay, so there are a variety of things that one might look at. One thing that you see in Scripture, now prior to the time of Jesus's death and resurrection, human saints, by and large, were not in heaven because it was his death and resurrection that allowed human saints to get into heaven in a regular way. There had been a few exceptions like Enoch and Elijah before that, but most human saints were waiting in a pleasant state, but not in the full glory of heaven until after the time of Jesus. So the individuals that were in heaven prior to the time of Jesus were angels. And they were the principal ones who populated heaven, and God would send them as messengers to do various things or as his agents to do various things in the world. And whenever people on earth encountered an angel and realized it was an angel, their first response was always awe, because angels are superior to human beings. As the scripture says, God made us a little lower than the angels. So angels are higher in rank than we are, and they're also more powerful than we are, which makes them a little intimidating. And so whenever you see humans encountering angels and realizing that it's an angel, the human starts to show a lot of respect and even fear. And that's why when angels show up, one of the first things they frequently say in Scripture is, don't be afraid. And they need to reassure humans, because humans are naturally afraid when they encounter something beyond our experience that's more powerful than we are and closer to God than we are and so forth. But you will see humans doing things like bowing and paying them respects and things like that. You even see a tendency like this in the New Testament. You see it on the part of the Virgin Mary. When the angel Gabriel shows up to her, one of the first things Gabriel says is, don't be afraid. He says the same thing to Zechariah. And so we see the inhabitants of heaven already being shown respect, even in Scripture. Then after the time of Jesus, as humans began to join in a regular way the population of heaven, you see Christians understanding that it's all they should also be paid their appropriate respects. And so in the writings of the early church fathers, you have indications of, for example, asking the saints, the human saints in heaven, for their intercession, asking them to pray for us. We see that in inscriptions from the catacombs from the very earliest centuries. We also have early Christian writers talking about asking for their intercession. And of course, if someone's praying for you, you want to say thanks. You want to show your appreciation. And so you also have indications of a growing veneration and respect and awareness of the fact that we have brothers and sisters in heaven. They're part of God's family, and we want to show them the same respect that we show other people. And even more so because they have become what we need to be. They have become completely sanctified or sanctified. Here in this life, we still struggle with sin. We're imperfect. We're not what we should be. But the people who are with Jesus in heaven have become perfected by his grace. And so we owe them even more respect.
Giovanni, I have to go to a break. I want to say thank you very much for the call. I hope that that was helpful to you.
Jimmy, I also wanted to mention I've got a book called The Fathers Know Best, which tracks the teachings of the early church fathers on different subjects, including the intercession of the saints. So I'd recommend that book to you. It's called The Fathers Know Best.
Giovanni, you mentioned your situation. I don't know if you'd like us to, but we'd be happy to send you a free copy of that book. I'll tell you what, just hang on the line. Marie can talk with you, and you can let her know if you're in a position where you'd be comfortable getting a free copy of Jimmy's book, The Fathers Know Best. Well, take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. We've got two great episodes of Catholic Answers Focus this week. Monday, we did an interview with Father Hugh Barber about the Sacred Heart and its biblical roots, its medieval roots, and what it especially means to modern people. And then Wednesday, why do we have a magisterium? Does that fit with the Bible, that we need a magisterium, especially when St. John says that we only need the Holy Spirit to teach us? That's with Carlo Broussard. You can get Catholic Answers Focus at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Dr. Doctor, featuring Drs. Tom McGovern, Chris Stroud, and Andrew Mullally.
The number of people who are on government assistance expanded so much. Personally, I had patients in my office in tears saying, you know, I never thought of myself as somebody on government assistance. I just bought a new car. I can afford a brand new car, but I'm still on Medicaid.
Dr. Doctor, Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's Open Forum, 888-31-TRUTH, the number. I want to encourage you, before this deal goes away, to see about getting the digital deal on Catholic Answers Magazine. It really is a fine magazine. Tim Ryland does a great job on it here. I think Jimmy Akin, virtually every issue's got something in there, and lots of other great writers as well, some from within this building here and some who from all around the world of Catholic apologetics and Catholic theology who contribute to the magazine. You can get 8 years a full 8 years worth of digital magazine issues for just $39.95 right now. 48 issues of Catholic Answers magazine for $39.95. Or you can, if you want to select a year, you can get that for less than $10 a year, a particular year you'd like to get the editions of the magazine for that year. Just visit the ebook and magazine sections at shop.catholic.com today and check out our new offerings there. Jimmy Akin's latest book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Hey, I'm going to go to Russ in Indiana here, but before I go to Russ, Jimmy, what's up this tomorrow with Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Oh, acupuncture.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Beginning in the 1970s here in the United States, acupuncture, which is a part of traditional Chinese medicine, became very popular. There are different explanations for how it's supposed to work, but there's also a question, does it actually work? So we're going to look into the history and the science of acupuncture and what it has to say about whether it works or not. And if it does, how, what would explain that?
Oh, fair enough. I sometimes people will say things like, well, in regard to things like acupuncture, well, it works, but it's just the placebo effect. So, you know, that doesn't really work. But if it works, it works. Like even if it's the placebo effect.
Well, we talk about whether the placebo effect and other non-specific causes might be playing a role here.
Oh, fair enough. All right. Let's go to Russ in Indiana. Russ, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, sorry. Jimmy, hi, Russ. I love your Mysterious World. I've listened to every episode so far. And I just finished reading The Bible as a Catholic Book, so I appreciate that. My question is, in Jesus' time, they didn't have chapter and verse in their Bible. So how would they have referred to different passages in the Bible? I think maybe in Luke, when they say Jesus found the part in Isaiah that says this, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
The way they do it when one writer, now if you're in the synagogue and you're reading from Isaiah, you just pick up the scroll and start reading. You don't say a reading from the seventh chapter of Isaiah or whatever, because they didn't have chapters back then. You just start reading it. But in terms of how a writer will refer, whether a biblical writer or someone who's not a biblical writer, but who's just writing about the Jewish scriptures, in terms of how they would describe the passage they're talking about, they would generally cite the author, assuming they remembered who the author was and they weren't just quoting from memory, but they'll cite who the author was. And sometimes they'll say, like, as Jeremiah says, and then they'll just start into the quote, because they don't have a way to further narrow it down to where Jeremiah says this. Or they will sometimes add a little bit and say something like, as Jeremiah says somewhere, which doesn't really tell you any more information, but it does indicate that it may not, you know, you may have to search around a little bit to find it. If there's more than one book attributed to an author, or if there's more than one book that's part of a set. They did have books back then. A book prior to the time of Christ was almost always a scroll. And that meant that if you wanted to write something really long, you had to use multiple scrolls, because nobody would want a scroll hundreds of pages long. It would be far too unwieldy to roll through that. So there was a finite length, pretty short length, to how long a scroll could be. That's why the Gospels are the size they are. They basically would fill a scroll. And so if you wanted to write a series of books on a subject, like the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, though originally that was five scrolls. And so you could identify the book, but not the chapter or verse within the book, because those didn't exist, but the books did. So you could say, as Moses says in Deuteronomy, for example, or if you're talking about another ancient work, like let's say Josephus's Antiquities of the Jews, which was 20 books long, it filled 20 scrolls. You could say, as Josephus says in the 16th book of his antiquities, blah, 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 blah. And so they could identify the book if it's a book that's part of a series, but they couldn't do chapter and verse. They just either start the quote or say, as he says somewhere.
How's that, Russ?
Oh, there is one extra thing they could do. If there was something famous in a particular part of the book, they might cite the famous thing that's in proximity to what they want to quote. For example, in Isaiah, what we call Isaiah 53, we have the story of the suffering servant, and or the prophecy of the suffering servant. And it goes on for a while, so there's a lot of little bits you could quote. But because the passage of the suffering servant overall is famous, you could say, as Isaiah says in the passage about the suffering servant, and then you could quote whatever little bit of it you wanted to call attention to. So you could use a famous thing as kind of a peg to direct them to that passage, even if there was no way to assign a number to it at the time.
Okay, Russ?
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Jimmy, what about the Psalms? Was that all just one book with individual Psalms in it? Was it like a songbook or something?
Yes. And those are the only chapters that were original in the Bible, but you wouldn't necessarily have them numbered.
Okay. Yeah, because they kind of each have a title to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Paul in Denver, Colorado. Oh, I hope that this is really, truly the question Paul wants to ask, because I want to know the answer to. Paul, you there with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much.
Well, happy to have you. What's your question for Jimmy?
Hey, Jimmy. Is it frowned upon in the Catholic Church for a Catholic to be a Grateful Dead fan?
Well, the Catholic Church has no teaching on the Grateful Dead, and therefore it is not a matter of church teaching. It's purely a matter of opinion. So I would imagine that Catholics who have a high opinion of the Grateful Dead would not look down on that. Catholics who have a low opinion of the Grateful Dead would look down on that. But it's like any other situation. You're going to have different fandoms who are fans of different things and who like different things. But in general, this isn't a matter of church teaching. It's just a matter of opinion and personal preference. Having said that, one wants to be a spiritually alert, critical consumer of any media that one is consuming. So whether it's the Grateful Dead or any other musical group or any movie or any book or any TV show, it's composed by fallen human beings. And from time to time, there are going to be problematic elements as a result of that fact. So there's going to be problematic elements in the Grateful Dead. There's going to be problematic elements in My Little Pony. So whatever the media you're consuming, you need to be a critical consumer who brings to bear the principles of the faith on that so that you can filter the problematic elements and appreciate what is good about it without approving of what's bad about it.
Paul, if I may, are you a Grateful Dead fan?
I am, and I feel much better about your comment there, because I have like over 20 Grateful Dead shirts in my closet.
I'm assuming some of them will be tie-dyed. Is that correct?
True deadhead.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, then take heart. As Jimmy said, you got to be. You have some critical faculties at work there, but that's also true of the My Little Pony fans. So I'd like all of you people with 20 My Little Pony shirts in your closet to consider. You have to be critical as well. Paul, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
I actually know a channel on YouTube where a guy does critical analyses of My Little Pony episodes from a writing perspective. I've never watched one, but I see that he does them.
That's high culture right there. That tells you everything you need to know about American culture right now. Let us go to, you know what, I'm going to be a little selective about my question right now, because there's one I want you to have more time with, Jimmy, in a minute. Let's go to Brian in Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Brian, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone, by the way. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes, thanks, guys, for taking my call. I have a question in regards to video games. I've heard Jimmy talk before in regards to magic, if it's in a video game or playing or anything along those lines, is if you aren't having the intention to do it, it's just fantasy, it's not a big deal. Well, in regards to a video game that my children wanted me to let them play again and kind of do as a family, they have gods in the video game. Now, all of us are well aware that these aren't real gods. But because of that, that was one of the reasons I didn't want to play it anymore, because occasionally you have to do a side quest where you do something for them, like you pick up something in one town and bring it to them somewhere else. So I wanted to know if that was a problem in playing the game.
Well, so one of the things that we want to be aware of now, by the way, which gods are we talking about? Are these like the Greek gods or the Norse gods or something?
They're just made up for this video game series.
So they're made up
gods.
They're
not even related to those.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, St. Paul read Greek literature. And we know that St. Paul read Greek literature because he quotes from it. He quotes from various Greek poets and authors in his letters and in his speech to the Areopagus. And that shows us that he was willing and thus the legitimacy of exposing oneself to that material and processing it critically. There's a little bit more to say about that, so we'll pick it up on the other side of the break.
All right, we'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Who are the Jehovah's Witnesses and what do they believe? How do you respond to their claims that God isn't a Trinity and Jesus isn't divine? What's the best way to evangelize Jehovah's Witnesses when they come knocking at the door? In 20 Answers, Jehovah's Witnesses, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, giving you the knowledge you need to respond to friends, family, and missionaries who try to steer you away from the church and into Kingdom Hall. 20 Answers, Jehovah's Witnesses is part of the 20 Answers series at Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. On the line, Brian in Ohio. We're talking about a video game that involves gods and magic. And Jimmy, you were in the midst of an answer.
Yeah, so we know that St. Paul read Greek literature because he quotes from it. And that shows us, among other things, that it's in principle okay to read Greek literature. That meant that he read about the different Greek gods, for example, and so he would have known about the various conflicts and the various shenanigans that the Greek gods got up to. He would have had familiarity with Greek mythology, and that meant that he would have had this in his head. You know, whenever we read stories, we imagine what's going on in the story. At least we do if we have, unless we have a condition called aphantasia, which is where you don't have a mind's eye that you imagine what's happening. There are some people who don't have that ability to visualize the situations they're reading about. And so they have a different experience when reading a book than most people do, because most people have a mind's eye, and so we imagine the scenarios. So that's kind of like, you know, watching a TV show. If you're St. Paul and you're reading about Greek mythology, you've got a little movie or TV show or video game like experience playing out in your head, where you're imagining, you know, Apollo runs into Mount Olympus and asks Zeus to borrow the keys to the chariot or whatever. But you're imagining these things, and that's essentially like playing a video game. St. Paul also quite likely may have, and I can't prove this, but he may have even experienced Greek theater, because Greeks would put on a lot of their literature in the form of plays. So you'd see plays that had gods in them. In fact, that's where we get the phrase Deus ex machina, which is the kind of twist ending at the end of a play where something magical happens to fix the main plot problem. In ancient Greek plays, what they would do is they would have an actor playing a god or a goddess who they would get onto the stage by use of a machine, you know, like a winch. They'd lower them down onto the stage or something, and then the god would solve all the problems. And so that's where we got the phrase Deus ex machina, or the god from the machine. St. Paul, because he was a Roman citizen, he very well may have even gone and seen plays involving gods. But even if he didn't see plays, he did read Greek literature and have those scenarios in his mind. And so there's not, in principle, anything wrong with watching a TV show or playing a video game just because it involves an imaginary deity, as long as you understand it's imaginary. On the other hand, different people have different vulnerabilities, and some people, if it's going to be spiritually bad for them if they do play those games or watch those shows. And so even though there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it, it could be wrong for different people. And it's up to you, Brian, as a parent, in consultation with your wife, to make the best decision for your own family, given your knowledge of your children, which, of course, you know them far better than I do, and whether this would pose a serious spiritual risk to them or not. That's for you and your wife to discern prayerfully.
Thank you, Brian. Lots of folks on the line. Going to keep moving. I hope that was helpful to you. Let's go to Connor in St. Petersburg, Florida, watching on YouTube Live. Hi, Connor. What's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Thanks for taking my call, first
Happy
of all.
To.
My question is, when were the four Gospels written, and then how do we know?
Okay, well, there are different opinions on this, and I do talk about them in my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Basically, virtually all scholars agree that the Gospels were written in the first century AD. And there are a variety of evidences that scholars use to illustrate that. Everybody agrees that they were not written before the first century AD, because they refer to things that happened in the first century AD, like Jesus being executed during the reign of Pontius Pilate. Well, we know when Pilate was the governor of Judea. It was between AD 26 and 36. So if Jesus was executed within Pilate's reign, that gives us a kind of lower threshold from they couldn't have been written earlier than this, since they are talking about this. On the other hand, when we get into writings in the second century, we find them quoting from the Gospels, and so that means they would be written before the second century. In fact, we even have like a fragment of the Gospel of John that's from, it's dated different ways, but you know, some people date it as early as AD 125. It's called the Rylands Papyrus. And so if we've got an actual fragment of the Gospel of John, which based on the way the Gospels relate is recognized as being the latest, well, if we have one from, say, 125 AD, it's probably not a copy of the original. So John's Gospel would have been written sometime before
AD 125 and probably a few decades before AD 125, which would put it in the first century. And then if John's is the latest, then that would put the other Gospels in the first century as well. So the question is, when in the first century were the Gospels written? And here there are different opinions. The majority opinion would say that, and there are even variations within this, but the majority of scholars would say that Mark's Gospel was the first one written and that it was likely written between AD 65 and 70. Or maybe just a few years after AD 70. Then Matthew and Luke were written between the 70s and the 80s, and John's Gospel was written in the 90s. And if that's the way it turns out, that's fine. You know, that's very close to the time of Jesus. It's certainly close enough for living memory to still be there and for accurate information about Jesus to be recorded in the Gospels. And we have good reason to trust the evidence about Jesus in the Gospels. It's a different question than the one you're asking, though. Personally, I think the Gospels were written earlier. There is a different position among other scholars, and I favor that one. I think the Gospels were written earlier. I think that you can date the book of Acts, which is the sequel to Luke, to the year 60 AD, approximately. And since Acts is the sequel to Luke, I think you can date Luke to just before Acts. I think Luke was written about AD 59. I think they were both written during the Paul's two-year Roman captivity in AD 59 and 60. Well, Mark is earlier than Luke, but can't be too much earlier because Mark is based on the preaching of Peter and didn't become Peter's traveling companion until maybe AD 50. So I think Mark was written sometime in the AD 50s. Call it AD 55. So you got Mark in 55, you got Luke in 59, Acts in 60. I think Matthew's gospel was written in the AD 60s, probably around AD 63 or 64. I think John's gospel, surprisingly, also was written in the AD 60s, because if you read the Greek text, he refers to Peter dying in the future. So Peter is not dead yet in the Greek text of John, and we know Peter died around AD 65 or 66. So I think John was written shortly before Peter's death. So I think you've got Mark around AD 55, Luke AD 59, Acts AD 60, Matthew around 63, and John around 65. But if you want the details on that, check out my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book.
How is all that, Connor? Make sense to you?
Yeah, that does make sense. But can I ask one more question?
Yes, but before you do, I want to tell you something. Jimmy said you can find us all in his book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, and we do want to send you a free copy of it. So when we're done here, don't go anywhere. I'll put you on hold. And if you want, we'll get your address and we'll send you a free copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book. All right, follow-up question. Go ahead.
So what's the argument that it was written later? Like what are the, like, I know some people think that they were written later, but what's the evidence for that?
The evidence, frankly, is not very good. What people will cite, and the Jewish temple was destroyed in AD 70, and scholars will look at certain passages in the Gospels, particularly in what's called the Olivet Discourse, which is Jesus's prophecy from the Mount of Olives about the destruction of the temple. And they will go through the Olivet Discourse and try to find tiny little clues and say, ooh, this just ever so subtly suggests maybe it was written after AD 70. But when you read the Gospels as a whole, that's just not the way these passages read. When you had the evangelists writing, they were all about Jesus being a true prophet of God. And so they record it when one of Jesus's prophecies has been fulfilled. For example, Jesus says the Son of Man is going to be betrayed and he's going to be crucified and die and rise on the third day. And guess what the evangelists record? They record the Son of Man being betrayed and tried by Gentiles and crucified and died and rising from the dead. thus showing Jesus is a true prophet. Well, other than his own death and resurrection, Jesus's most famous prophecy, which is alluded to in all four of the Gospels, is the destruction of the temple. And he said it was going to happen within a generation, and it did. It happened in AD 70. So what would you expect the evangelists to do? You would expect them to say, and it happened just like Jesus said, if they're writing after AD 70. But they don't. They don't record that prophecy being fulfilled. And so to say, we've got to rely on these subtle little maybe if kinda allusions really doesn't cut it. I always hate to psychologize why people adopt the positions they do. I rather prefer to look at the evidence for their positions. But this is really part of a historical trend where about 200 years ago, you had a very skeptical school of thought develop in Turbingen in Germany. And they wanted to say, some of them wanted to say, the Gospels weren't written until the AD 200s or even or until the second or even third centuries. Some of them as late as the 200s. And scholarship has progressively pushed the dates earlier and earlier, but they're still fighting that tendency that got started with the Turbingen school. And so that's why a lot of scholars want to put them as late in the first century as possible, even if it means reading the evidence in kind of a wonky way. It's part of that historical trend.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you for those questions, Connor. Hang on. If you'd like to get that book, then Marie will get your address and we will send the book to you. Hey, right now we've got that free ebook, Did the Church Add Books to the Bible? You hear that accusation? Is it true? Was there a shorter version of the Bible and the church added books to them? Go to shop.catholic.com right now. Click on the banner at the bottom of the page to download your free ebook version of Did the Church Add Books to the Bible? That's shop.catholic.com.
Call now, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Father Robert Spitzer.
First of all, you will get a much deeper awareness of your faith, much deeper awareness of the evidence for your faith, explanations of tough theological issues, how science and reason and faith come together, and above all, a deeper awareness of how to practice your faith and how to live it.
Father Spitzer's Universe with Father Robert Spitzer. Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
You're just building tension, Nick. Are you building tension on purpose? Because it's Thursday and Jimmy's here. You know what I'm talking about, right? And are you just intentionally building? All right. Intentional tension. 888-31-TRUTH is our number here. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. We mentioned a couple times already, but he's the author most recently of a book called The Bible is a Catholic Book. He has other books, including, I think we might have mentioned The Fathers Know Best earlier. He wrote The Drama of Salvation. He wrote A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, all of which are available on our website, shop.catholic.com. Plus, you can go to jimmyakin.com, read what he wrote there, or you can just type in Jimmy Akin into the Google machine, and you will get all kinds of info on Jimmy. Tomorrow, the weekly episode will be out of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Up next, Yossi in Oakland, California. Do I have that right? Watching on YouTube Live. Yossi, you there with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Your question for Jimmy, Yossi.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk with you guys.
Oh, it's nice to have you.
And my question is, I've recently started buying books from the Church Fathers, and what stuck out to me is, like, why is St. Augustine given a prominent role in the Catholic Church compared to the other fathers? Because there are plenty of fathers to read, and I was just wondering why the Catholic Church mainly focuses on St. Augustine.
Well, when you say the Catholic Church mainly focuses on St. Augustine, where do you see the Catholic Church doing this?
Are
you
the doctor of the church?
Yeah, he's one of more than 30. He is a doctor of the church. Yeah, but there's more than 30 doctors of the church. Now, St. Augustine is a popular church father. One of the reasons for that is he's very, very intelligent. Another is that he wrote an enormous amount that has survived. So we have more of his writings than just about anybody else. He just wrote a ton of books. And so between the fact that he's very intelligent and very prolific, he writes lots and lots that we still have, you know, that's made him a popular figure among the church fathers, but there's by no means an exclusive emphasis on him. There, if you were to go through the Catechism of the Catholic Church, some editions of it, for example, will have indexes in the back of the quotations from different figures in the early church. And while you might find Augustine gets more, if you counted them up, you might find that Augustine gets more mentions than some early church fathers, he's not going to have the majority. The majority of the quotations are going to be a hodgepodge of quotations from all kinds of different church fathers, and even some writers who were not church fathers, but who did live in the early ages. Tertullian, because even though he's not a church father, he is a very valuable early Christian writer to know about. So the church doesn't have any kind of exclusive focus on Augustine. He is very highly respected. He is popular among the church fathers for the reasons I mentioned, but it's not an exclusive thing.
Okay. Thanks for pointing that out to me. And also, What I noticed is, like in Christianity, there are two forms of, like there is a whole other group called Eastern Christians, and I don't see them like quoting Augustine, or I don't see their respective churches like and doing what any.
Go ahead. Well, one of the reasons that St. Augustine is not quoted as much in Eastern non-Catholic circles, now there are Eastern Catholics, but it's true that he's not quoted as much, especially among Eastern non-Catholics. There are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is St. Augustine wrote in Latin, and Eastern-speaking Christianity didn't use Latin a lot. Most Eastern-speaking theologians and bishops didn't know Latin, and so they would speak languages like Greek or Syriac or Slavonic or things like that, and they didn't have translations of Augustine's writings into their own languages frequently, and so they didn't historically quote him as much because he was just writing in a language they didn't have access to. There's also sometimes, and this is regrettable, but it's a human reality, there's also sometimes some friction between Eastern groups and Western groups. And consequently, people in the Eastern groups might say, oh, Augustine, he's that Latin guy from the West. And they might value his writings a little less than they otherwise might have if he was a fellow Easterner writing in Greek or Syriac or something like that.
Thank you, Yossi, very much for the call. Hope that was helpful to you. Our number, 888-318-7884. Up next, RJ in Myerstown, Pennsylvania, listening on Catholic.com. RJ, your question for Jimmy.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. Before I actually get to the question, I would like to, if I could, I'd like to give you the scenario or the situation I'm in before I actually give the question, if that's okay.
Keep it family friendly.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, this is very, very family friendly. Our church, which I am Catholic my whole life, and I sincerely believe in everything the Catholic Church teaches. But every year our parish has a parish festival, which is an extremely family event, family oriented event. And we recently started a beer garden. Now, mm-hmm. I understand and I agree that there's nothing wrong with drinking beer. The problem, or the thing that I'm concerned about, is the atmosphere that we put our children and our neighbors into. And basically, I'm wondering if by having a beer garden, it possibly could be scandalous to our neighbors, our non-Catholic friends, and maybe saying that, you know, it's okay to publicly drink.
Jimmy?
So let me ask you a question, RJ. Is it wrong to drink?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. So is it wrong to drink in public?
No, it's not.
Okay. So this would be an example of people doing a behavior that's legitimate to do in public, and they're doing it in public. So we then have to say, well, what's the reaction of other people? Let's talk about adults first. Other adults teetotalers might say, well, I don't approve of that. And they might get offended in the sense of being annoyed or angry about it. Well, you can't, that's not offense. That's not something that is automatically a problem. If you're doing something legitimate and somebody else gets mad about it, you know, you don't want to encourage situations where that happens. And you might say, well, I'm going to refrain in this particular instance. But if you make a habit of that, of avoiding conflict at all costs and avoiding people feeling annoyed at all costs, you're gonna not actually serve God's kingdom well, because people are going to walk all over you and you're going to be paralyzed and you're going to be second guessing everything you do in terms of, could someone possibly get mad at this? So if there's a particular situation where someone's going to get so mad that there are going to be further problems, like, I don't know, they go on a shooting spree, well, then sure. Obviously, in that situation, you want to avoid the thing that's going to cause them to lash out in that way. There's another kind of taking offense, though, which is where someone gets led into sin. And there could be people who have particular temptations towards the abuse of alcohol. And they could see your parish having its beer garden, and they could fall into sin. But that's true of everything. People get tempted towards everything. And you can't, once again, shut down a legitimate activity just because some people have particular temptations. You want to pray for those people. You want to, if you know someone is in Alcoholics Anonymous or something, maybe you don't invite them to the parish festival. But you don't want to be paralyzed by what may happen due to other people's use of free will. Then we could look at the situation in terms of not are people going to be angry or fall into sin. We could look at it from the perspective of, are they being drawn to the gospel? Well, there are some people in the United States who are so opposed to the consumption of alcohol that it would push them away. And those people are a vast minority. There are not very many of those people. There are many more people in American society who have an image of religious people as a bunch of stuck-up blue noses who have no ability to have fun and just want to rain on everybody's parade and who don't live in a human manner.
Like Nick.
And for those people to see Catholics doing something as human as having a beer, that would actually wake them up and say, hey, you know, these Catholics are human beings too. They're not the rigid people I thought they were. And so actually, I think in an American context today, the net benefit of having a beer garden is it's going to wake up more people to, hey, Catholics aren't a bunch of rigid prudes like I thought, or not as much as I thought, as opposed to people who are going to be horrified and get their pearls in a twist about the fact Catholics are drinking beer. Then when it comes to children, what we want to do for children is set a good example. We want to show them responsible behavior. And as long as the beer garden is being run in a responsible behavior, in a responsible way, you're modeling responsible behavior for them.
RJ, thank you. I'd suggest also maybe throw in some square dancing. That'll make it fun. Jimmy Akin is our guest. He calls square dancing. He's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. The author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, and it is open forum. So whether you're Catholic or not, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884.